It's Tuesday, September 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Financial markets brace for the outcome of U.S. presidential politics.
This is inhumane, merciless, sinful, indeed barbaric.
Calls continue for action to stop fighting amid aid civilians in Syria, and a classic rock band slowly disappears. It's all on today's International Edition. The stage is set for what could be a pivotal moment in the 2016 U.S. presidential election as Republican Donald Trump, the brash real estate mogul, and Democrat Hillary Clinton, a former Secretary of State, debate each other for 90 minutes just a short time from now at Hofstra University outside of New York City. VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone is with us to analyze perhaps the most anticipated presidential debate ever.
Often the history of debates shows that the unexpected is something that people focus on after the debate. You can have a lot of preparations for each of the candidates. Some of them will study a lot of briefing books. Apparently, Donald Trump is not in that class. He prefers to kind of prepare the way he has in the primary debates, and that is not as intensely as, say, Hillary Clinton. But when you have just two people on the stage with a moderator, the unexpected can happen. And I'm sure they've both been told by aides, you know, be willing to react to that quickly, deal with the unexpected. But, you know, you've got to feel for them in a way, because all the preparation in the world, when you're standing there and the TV lights are on and maybe 100 million people are watching, including many around the world, it's got to be very intense.
That's an astounding number to think about, because this ranks up with some of the all-time watched programs ever. And to know as a candidate that that many people are watching you live and you're up there for 90 minutes straight with no break has to be tremendous pressure.
Yeah, you know, in the context of our presidential campaigns, which are long, we have the primary battles, we have the conventions, and now we have the debates. And this is really critical. We have 6 weeks to go. And this first debate in particular historically has been significant. The person who tends to be seen as the winner, you know, often goes on to win. The polls show a close race at the moment, much closer than I think Clinton and the Democrats had thought even several weeks ago. So the stakes for this first debate are quite high. And if you look back to previous debates, it was something like 67 million people were watching 4 years ago for the first Romney-Obama debate. And you have to go back to 1980. I think the biggest audience of all time was around 80 million. And that was a crucial moment in the campaign between Ronald Reagan, then the challenger, and the president, Jimmy Carter.
Briefly, strategically, what do each of the candidates need to achieve?
Well, I think Clinton wants to show her advantages, which is she knows a lot about policy. She has experience in government. She wants that to be a good thing because we're in the year of the outsider. But more importantly for Clinton, there's an issue there with trustworthiness and relating to people. So I think she's going to focus on that. Trump, on the other hand, he has his hardcore followers. He needs to be mindful that if he goes off track and maybe is insulting, he could lose the people in the soft middle who may be coming to him now, according to the polls, willing to give him a shot, provided they see him as someone who's disciplined and moderate. And so for Trump, we may see a kind of different kind of Trump, more subdued, but we'll have to see, because I'm sure they've told the Clinton camp that they might try to get under Trump's skin somehow to get a reaction. We'll see how that goes.
Our most trusted political insider, VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
And be sure to stay tuned, because we have two more Trump-Clinton debates scheduled in October. The election, of course, is on November 8th. Right now, it's time for us to check social media and the pulse on our top story. And as always, G. Abby Lee has been following the trends on Facebook, Twitter, and more. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. So many hashtags, as you know, that's kind of typical for a debate night. Mm-hmm. And the main hashtag for tonight is hashtag debate night. And when you use that on Twitter, it will automatically generate an image of a podium in blue and red. The same image also pops up when you use hashtag debate and hashtag debates 2016.
Okay, so they all seem pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about some of the tweets that are using these hashtags.
Sure. OpenSecrets.org is one of them, and its handle is at OpenSecretsDC. And it encouraged people to follow their staff members on Twitter to understand the money and influence behind the candidates. On the Republican side, Rand Paul announced he will be live tweeting the debate and naturally made the announcement on Twitter. He was a GOP presidential hopeful but quickly suspended his campaign earlier this year. And on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders' staff sent out multiple tweets supporting Clinton, and one of them is a short clip from his interview on a CBS TV program called Face the Nation that emphasized the two candidates' views on climate change. Trump thinks it's a hoax.
Hmm. Well, so many good things to follow. What else is trending about this first debate?
Well, let's talk about Snapchat. CNN snaps are about the five things to watch for on the debate night, and the title for that is Ready to Rumble. So you know it's going to be a very exciting night. Online publication Mashable also snapped about tonight about the fact that you can now register to vote through Snapchat.
Wow, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. How does that work?
It's pretty simple, actually. So Snapchat partnered with another app called Turbo Vote. I haven't heard of it before, but it's apparently a vote registration app. So TurboVote videos are located in the Snapchat's stories and discovery pages. And in the videos, well-known celebrities like Jimmy Fallon and Dwayne The Rock Johnson instruct you to swipe up to access the vote registration page. So if you need famous people to convince you to register to vote, you can go right ahead to Snapchat. That's all for me today, Jim.
Wow, thanks for that great wrap-up, G, and letting us know another way to register. You can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE, and, of course, our individual accounts are also out there. I'm at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G Abby Lee. Thank you. Among the top stories that are currently trending in Asia: Islamic State retakes control of former strongholds in Afghanistan. Afghan official confirms airstrike killed senior Pakistani militant leader. Human Rights Watch says Pakistan's police abusing and killing suspects. The United States-South Korea exercise for military option with naval drill. Australians demand tougher action to combat climate change. These headlines are part of expanded coverage on our VOANews.com website, and you also find these stories on your smartphone via our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Dozens of Syrian and Russian airstrikes on the rebel-held eastern sector of Aleppo has created what UN Syria envoy Staffan de Mistura has called a chilling, appalling, and tragic situation. Speaking after an emergency UN Security Council meeting, de Mistura said the U.S.-Russian cessation of hostilities announced September 9th risks, in his words, becoming devoid of credibility.
On the 18th of September, airstrikes did resume on Aleppo. Since then, we have seen the most sustained, intense bombardment since the start of the Syrian conflict on Aleppo in particular. The level of airstrikes is unprecedented in quantity and also in the scale and type. This is inhumane, merciless, sinful, indeed barbaric. It may be tantamount to criminal. It must stop. There are also reports of AOGs firing the so-called Hellfire rockets, canisters of gas full of ammunition, at the civilian targets. This must stop as well. 275,000 people are still living in eastern Aleppo. They cannot be all terrorists. But they are under constant form of now de facto a siege for more than 20 days, and hundreds of them have been killed since the airstrikes have returned.
The UN diplomat said the responsibility in ending the fighting rests with the United States and Russia, who brokered the ceasefire. Analyst Abdulkader Sino of Indiana University tells VOA's Victor Beatty the forces of President Bashar al-Assad, facing defeat just a year ago, sense they now have the momentum to capture all of the vital city.
It will be a tremendous victory for him. He already controls most of Damascus, and Aleppo is actually the largest city in Syria. If he can control it, he can really claim legitimacy and victory on a large scale.
Well, the rhetoric at the UN got rather heated. Samantha Power, the U.S. UN ambassador, said what Russia is sponsoring and doing is not counterterrorism, it's barbarism.
And she's absolutely correct. Also, however, one has to keep in context the fact that the Russians have their own grievances, and they're using Syria to really get even with the United States, especially against sanctions that the United States has imposed on them in the past. So for them, it's an opportunity to get even.
The Russian ambassador, Vitaly Churkin, insisted that the U.S. is at fault because it's unable to separate al-Qaeda and Islamic State from other rebel groups. Is that a feasible argument?
No, because no one can do so. How can you separate those groups from others alongside which they fight? Listen, the resistance in Syria, opposition in Syria, has very limited options. And they're formed of different groups of people for reasons that have nothing to do with Russia or the United States. And it makes no sense to a more moderate opposition group to separate themselves from al-Qaeda or other organizations along which they fight. They are at a disadvantage vis-a-vis the regime. If they start fighting each other, they're going to lose immediately or very fast to the regime and Russia. It's unrealistic to ask them to start fighting each other just to satisfy the needs of foreign powers. And certainly not in the capacity of the United States to do so, because they can't possibly convince them to do so, because they're intertwined geographically and otherwise. In fact, they share the same front, and they cooperate really well, at least the previous al-Qaeda organization, Nusra Front, which changed its name right now, and other opposition groups. ISIS is more separate in most areas and can be isolated, and here the Russians have no argument.
The UN Syria mediator, Stefan de Mistura, appealed to the Security Council to come up with a way to enforce a ceasefire. He said he's still convinced we can turn the course of events. Is he overly optimistic?
Extremely so, because he's not taking into consideration the incentives of the Russians and the Syrians and the lack of readiness of the Obama administration to actually intervene more forcefully with the Russians and the Syrians.
Abdulkader Sino says the fall of Aleppo to Syrian-backed forces will likely have a domino effect elsewhere in the country, leading to the defeat of the anti-Assad forces. He also said it would be a foreign policy disaster for the Obama administration, which he said has been outmaneuvered by Moscow. U.S. financial markets continue a modest slide down amid problems at Germany's Deutsche Bank as the giant lender faces the prospect of a $14 billion fine from the U.S. Justice Department for its lending practices and sale of mortgages at the height of the 2008 financial crisis. Also creating some uncertainty is the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Investors are watching closely, as VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino from New York is.
And along with 100 million other expected viewers as well, it's also the next near-term catalyst if either candidate can emerge as the clear winner going into the debates tonight. There's a lot of debate, if you will, on who's going to have the strongest showing. In terms of what the markets are looking for, given recent headlines, for example, both financial services, especially what's happening with Deutsche Bank today, and healthcare sectors will likely be areas of critical focus. We're going to want to hear about too big to fail in domestic and international banks. And we're also going to hear about cost of medical health care and also medicine. So both candidates will likely highlight the need for more cybersecurity. That's another area, and also boost investor sentiment for that group. So I'll be looking for names tomorrow to see how they trade in the tech sector. Energy names may be the most exposed to the post-debate of who won, who lost. Really, it's going to come down to deregulation of certain sectors within the market. But I think of the three sectors out of the 11, energy, financial, and healthcare is where the most impact is going to be felt.
We have heard so much speculation about which way the markets may go, depending on which candidate does better or not, or who would eventually become elected. What we do know is that we're in a period right now where the Federal Reserve has not adjusted interest rates, and it looks like at some point later this year, that may happen.
Right. And even though we got through the meeting last Wednesday where we got the decision to not do anything with interest rates, you have 10 Federal Reserve members on the speaking circuit this week, and that includes includes Chair Janet Yellen, largely focusing on minority and community banking and the economic outlook. In addition to the Fed, the Bank of Japan minutes from July will be released, and Governor Kuroda is also scheduled to speak at two events. So even though we're focusing on the debates today, and that will really dominate conversation for most of the week, the fact that central bank activity is really what's driving the markets is a theme that's going to continue through the end of the year until we get the interest rate hike potentially in December. And I think once we make an adjustment in monetary policy, then you'll see the rest of the world follow along with that. So I think really that's going to be the key outside of third quarter earnings and the debates.
And a little tough to really gauge which way the Fed is going to go in terms of sentimentality, because we got a little bit of a head fake the last time where some of the Fed members were talking tough, and then all of a sudden, no, we didn't have a rate increase.
Well, that's why traders are so frustrated as well, because they say something during the press conference following the interest rate decision. Then the minutes come out and the language is a little bit different then, which I've never seen in almost 20 years of being on Wall Street, the amount of Fed speakers making the rounds in between the meetings. And I think that's what's also giving a head fake to the markets as well, because they hear one thing, something else is done, and then the minutes are completely different. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and one thing markets don't like is uncertainty. This is what the Fed's giving it right now.
But we always get the straight information out of New York. Thanks to Jill Malandrino. Jill, thank you so much for spending time with us.
All right. Thank you.
You can check out more on this and all of the election news on our website at voanews.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter as well at @VOA_IE. And while you're online, check out our Facebook page. It's VOA Now. You can like us if you like. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. It's inevitable. Our favorite music artists and groups evolve as they age, and it's true for one of rock and roll's enduring bands from the 1970s, as VOA Top 20 host Ray McDonald joins us to explain.
You can file this one under the category of Time Marches On. Stuff happens. And stuff has been happening to AC/DC over the past 2 years. This band is down to one original member. That's guitarist Angus Young. On Tuesday, their bass player Cliff Williams gave his final performance with AC/DC in Philadelphia. Cliff is 66. He says he just spends more time with his family. He wants to get off that endless treadmill of recording and touring. In 2014, Angus Young's brother, guitarist Malcolm Young, left the band after he was diagnosed with dementia. AC/DC's drummer Phil Rudd is not in the band anymore due to a drug conviction. Mm-hmm. Their singer, Brian Johnson, is battling hearing loss, although Brian does admit he loves racing cars, and he says the blame might be on his cars rather than his bandmates. In any event, Brian's not on the tour. Axl Rose of Guns N' Roses was his replacement on this tour. For those who don't know, AC/DC is one of the world's biggest rock bands. They formed in Australia in 1973. They've been making albums since 1975, and they've sold more than 200 million records worldwide. These guys are major league rock stars. They entered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2003. So the possibility of AC/DC vanishing it's kind of a big deal, although that might not happen. Angus Young, the sole remaining original member, posted a video this week. He says music is his world, and even at the age of 61, he still has stamina. He says he paces himself, and he still has the desire to make music. So it doesn't sound like Angus is ready to hang it up, although what this means for AC/DC proper remains very much to be seen.
Without so many of the core members, if you will, we've seen this with a lot of the 60s singing groups where some of the original members are no longer with us for one reason or another, and you go to a show and you see maybe one or two, and the rest are all replacements.
When is a group not a group? Back in the 80s, Pink Floyd had a big split when Roger Waters left, but they continued as Pink Floyd for many years. The band Yes has no original members anymore. The one remaining original member, Chris Squire, passed away. Some of the members will be reforming under a new name. So, it's just a continual process of change.
Always classic in our book is Ray McDonald. He's the host of our Top 20 Countdown. You'll find it every week. It's VOA 1 each Thursday.
And you can catch me on Twitter at Ray on the Hits.
Love to follow your stream. Ray, thanks so much.
You got it, Jim.
You've been listening to International Edition. You'll find us at voanews.com, on Facebook at VOA Now, and on Twitter at VOA_IE. Be sure to follow the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump right here on VOA. It's coming up shortly. There's no debate. Our best director and engineer, Tracy Carter and Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Stick around for the debate.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When a country is deemed to have stepped outside of international norms or standards, the community of nations may impose sanctions against the sitting government, non-state actors, or individuals deemed to be responsible for offending acts. The idea is to persuade the offending parties to change their policy by restricting trade, investment, or other commercial activity, and, in the case of individuals, travel to the United States. In the early years of this century, such was the case with Côte d'Ivoire. Seeking to facilitate peace negotiations to put an end to the country's bloody civil war, the United Nations imposed targeted sanctions on certain individuals who significantly contributed to the conflict. Many in the international community followed that lead, including the United States, which imposed sanctions on specific individuals beginning in 2006. Then, in 2010, Ivorians elected opposition leader Alassane Ouattara to the presidency. The president was recognized by the international community as the country's new leader. Nonetheless, the incumbent, Laurent Gbagbo, refused to give up the presidency, and the fighting, which had largely ceased in 2007, was renewed. More sanctions were imposed by the United Nations, as well as by individual countries, including the United States. On September 14th of this year, recognizing that the situation in Côte d'Ivoire has vastly improved, President Barack Obama lifted U.S. sanctions on the Ivory Coast. President Obama determined that Côte d'Ivoire's advances in restoring peace and democracy and developing its political, administrative, and economic institutions represent significant improvements since President Bush declared the national emergency in 2006, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner in a written statement. Côte d'Ivoire has taken important steps to strengthen its governing and economic institutions and reconcile the differences that led to war, said White House National Security Council spokesman Ned Price in a separate statement. Challenges remain as the country continues to tackle difficult land reform issues and works to ensure that the benefits of economic growth are felt throughout the Ivorian population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.